away rights, of just making life more difficult for, first of all, the indigenous folks, and then other people who came to try to eke out a living out here. Yeah, that's been a long-term strategy. Not everyone was Hawaii nationalist, but it certainly was part of the whole makeup of nation building in Canada, because the White Canada movement was pretty much hand in hand with the founding of Canada, British Columbia, Vancouver, etc. It'd be nice to think that that era is long and gone, but it keeps rearing its head. There's a long tradition of racism in these parts and in Canada. It's going to take a long time for us as a nation, us as a society, to really move beyond that. And every once in a while, it raises its ugly head, like during COVID, all the anti-Asian, not just rhetoric, but actual violence. And what's happening south of the border, targeting people, raising specters, and then vigilante groups, you know, really chomping at the bit to inflict some pain, and being supported by other people in power, you know, implicitly or explicitly. So, you know, there's so many lessons that we need to learn from the recent past, and because it ain't over, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it really, white supremacy is really woven into the fabric of this country as a colonial state that is, as you said, has been and continues to be sort of the explicit goal of the state in many ways.
Yeah, and it's not just Canada that does this. There are specific racisms all around the world. There are tribalisms, there's antagonisms, there's the demonization of other cultures or religions, or, you know, whether it be class-based systems as well. So, you know, all these power imbalances are contribute towards pain and suffering of a lot of people.
Related to that, one of the instances of that through history are the 1907 anti-Asian riots here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. For people who might not know, can you just give sort of a recap of what those were?
Yeah, sure. So the riots resulted from a parade and demonstration organized by the Asiatic Exclusion League of Vancouver. It was a local, almost like a franchise of something that started off in the United States in San Francisco the year prior. So there are local chapters up and down the coast. It was hardly a new thing, anti-Asian activism. It went back to the gold rush when Chinese miners came to hopefully strike it rich, just like other men from around the world. And there were massacres, literally massacres. I think the largest one on the West Coast was in San Francisco. LA had theirs. Tacoma had theirs. In some cases, they just rounded up all the Chinese and kicked them out of town. But there were other times where just all these white men came out with their rifles and started shooting. The same thing happened with the South Asian mill workers, especially in Bellingham, just 3 days before our riot here. So the Asiatic Exclusion League organized a really large demonstration to promote their agenda, but also to put pressure on the federal government to change the ways in which Asian people could come into Canada. They wanted to restrict all access from Hong Kong or China or Japan, and also India. And that's another story, but it is connected to all this anti-Asian activity. So on September 7th, they organized their first public event. It was only just over a month old as an organization when they had their first meeting. Some 400 men came out. They're all white men, including the mayor of Vancouver, Alexander Bethune, and other city councillors, clergymen. It was organized by a trade organization called the Vancouver Trades and Labor Council. Yeah, this was the first public event. Thousands of people came out for it, waving banners and flags that said Rule Britannia and White Canada Forever. It was led by the major of the military drill hall, 80 Street Drill Hall, right across from Stadium Station. There were two marching bands. The mayor and his wife was in a car. There weren't many cars back then. There was actually a cavalcade. And it made its way from, at that time, it was called Canby Street Grounds. And now it's called Larwell Park, and the Vancouver Art Gallery's still trying to build their new building there. So they started from there, heading north to Hastings, hung a right, and then turned right again at Main and Hastings, where City Hall used to be. There are actually tens of thousands of people who came out for this. In fact, estimates go up to 25 to 30,000 out of a population of 70,000 at the time.
Wow.
Although it fluctuated dramatically as workers came in and out of the city. It was boomtown, although at that time there was a depression. So all these inflammatory speeches were being made in our city hall and relayed out to the crowd. There were special guests from Seattle and New Zealand, anti-Asian activists, specialists, and the crowd got all riled up, and then a mob broke out, went to Chinatown. Everyone else was in Chinatown, and and Powell Street area was, they were already really nervous. Some people actually left town. They were so nervous. And their fears were realized when these people came down to beat them up, attack them. So everyone's already behind locked doors. No one's on the street. So they targeted very specifically the homes and businesses of where Chinese people were. They skipped the ones that weren't, or specifically white businesses. And then the Chinese started to organize. They set up patrols, they pulled out weapons, they went to the gun stores and bought up all the guns and ammunition they could, and they started to take back their street. So there was hand-to-hand combat out here, you know, along DuPont, along Main Street, like this area. It's hard to imagine, really. Mm-hmm. So it raged overnight. The police were caught off guard, which is kind of surprising, but there weren't that many police back then. They called out the fire department. They were completely overwhelmed by just the number of people fighting. It carried over to the Japanese-Canadian area the next day. They were prepared because they had time. So they had set up barricades and so forth. And so the fighting raged until early Monday morning. And I think one of the reasons why it stopped was it was pouring rain. So Monday morning rolls around. All the Chinese are on strike, shuts down the city. They would be on strike until Wednesday. The Japanese went to work, but at lunchtime, they all left. And then they had this big meeting outside at what we know as Oppenheimer Park. Back then, it was called Powell Street Grounds. And ironically, they were really pissed off. They wanted an apology. They wanted reparations. And ironically, the mayor had to come out and appease them. And the mayor was a card-carrying member of the Asiatic Exclusion League. And like I mentioned, he was out front and center in the cavalcade and fully supportive of the AEL. So he had to come and deal with that. Ottawa was not happy. It was embarrassing. They sent out a junior minister to conduct a royal commission. His name was William Lyon Mackenzie King. He cut his teeth on the riots with his report. There's another story connected around his surprise for the demands for compensation around damages to opium factories, which led to him proposing and having passed for the first time ever Canada's Opium Act, which began the war on drugs. And there were other repercussions that led to the restricting of the number of Japanese men who could come into Canada from that point on. Eventually led to the Chinese Immigration Act. Some people call it the Chinese Exclusion Act, which resulted in almost total exclusion of Chinese coming to Canada from 23 to 47. It resulted indirectly or directly to the Continuous Journey Act, which was an attempt to keep people from India from coming to Canada and other things. So, yeah, the riots were a big deal, and yet I didn't learn about it in a school growing up, and many of our children here still don't know.
Yeah, it's something that I myself had to go and seek out myself. It's not presented in the way that you would expect it to be as something that is a pretty huge moment, not only for here, but as you're saying, sort of countrywide. Right? What would you say is the legacy of the riots?
Well, the Asiatic Exclusion League, after the big riot, they were forbidden from having any future public demonstrations. However, they remained active as an organization. They actually grew quite a bit in numbers in the late teens, early 20s. They were instrumental in drafting up or contributing towards the Chinese Immigration Act. So they kept going. So the restrictions against non-white folks in Canada, they didn't really lift until after the Second World War. Hopefully, I think our kids in schools now learn about Japanese internment and what happened here. something similar happened in the U.S., but what did not happen in the U.S. was they didn't have all their property sold off to fund their own internment, like here in Canada. They were allowed to go back to the West Coast, whereas in Canada, they were restricted from doing that. They had the choice of going east from the internment camps or so-called back to Japan, even though most of them had never been to Japan. So it wasn't until 47 that all Canadians got the vote, except for, again, certain designations like Dukhobors and Indigenous folks and so forth. And, you know, it's really ironic that it took Canada's signing of this Declaration for Human Rights that came out of the United Nations right after the Second World War that prompted Canada to try to be a bit more, fair?
Less exclusionary, maybe?
Yeah. So,
you said you didn't learn about this in school. How did you learn about the 1907 anti-Asian riots?
Oh, you know, I'd probably need a hypnotist to bring me back to that moment. I don't really remember. However, I do remember the moment that I learned about the 1887 anti-Chinese riot, because it was a local gallery here in Chinatown called Center A. The director invited me to organize a curated dinner commemorating that. And I went, okay, how come I don't know about this? And it happened just a few months after the incorporation of the city. Chinese workers are brought in to clear the land in Cole Harbor area. And white workers got angry because, you know, they got paid more than the Chinese, which is why these land developers liked to use the Chinese, because they could pay them less. You know, back then, they were organizers in their unions, right? But it was white exclusive, with, as far as I know, only a couple exceptions. And they're really interesting exceptions, but that's another topic. So these hundreds of white men got steamboats to go out to Cole Harbor, and they attacked the workers there, burnt their bedding, burnt their tents, and then went off to Chinatown to attack that. So, yeah, I created this curated dinner called the Unwelcome Dinner, and that was just the precursor of what got me into looking deeper into the 1907 riots.
Tell me about the tour and what led you to do that, and then maybe just a little bit about the tour itself.
Yeah, sure. So, just before this project, the 360 video project, I had actually created a pop-up food event on the streets commemorating the 1907 riots in four locations along the parade and demonstration and then the riots. So it started off in Larwell Park, or what used to be called Canby Street Grounds. So I actually set up this makeshift table right outside, like between the the tank and the cannon, and offered food from five cultural perspectives to anybody walking by on the street to come and sit down and share what they knew about what happened on this very location in 1907. So the five foods were Indigenous, because we're on their land. White, because they think we're on their land. Or they thought. Chinese, Japanese, and Punjabi. So the Indigenous one was candied smoked salmon with pickled spruce tips. It was kind of high-end. The Chinese one was actually low-end. It was poor, what poor people would have been eating, which was congee, tiny little bit of ground pork, and very North American addition, some corn. I worked with the chef, Chris Barnholden, who's actually the son of Michael Barnholden, who I eventually would co-write the script with for 360 Riot Walk. The Japanese was mochi with a red bean paste inside. The Punjabi was dal with the chapati. And the white meal was nice. It was Sunday dinner. Do you know what that is?
So like roast beef with potatoes, maybe?
Yorkshire pudding.
Yorkshire pudding, sure.
Yeah. And horseradish.
Of course.
Yeah. So all the stuff was made fresh in the morning. The chef brought it out, and what needed to be reheated, we heated on a little propane stove. And it was sort of asking the question, what would you have eaten as an angry white man before you go out to attack the Chinese and the Japanese in their homes? And what would you have eaten just before they came to attack you in your homes? Or what would you have eaten watching the white men attack other Asians, but not you, because you just got attacked in Bellingham 3 days before? or what would you have eaten watching the white man attack Asians on your land? So, yeah, I mean, it happened in the four different locations going into Chinatown, also Powell Street area, as well as in front of where City Hall used to be, which is right next to the Carnegie Center, Main and Hastings.
Right, and so from that, from the sort of food-focused installation, you then decided to do a video tour, or what? How does that come about?
Yeah, thanks for bringing me back on track.
Of course, that's my job.
Yeah, it's like he's not answering my question.
Oh.
So to kick off these 4 weekends of these pop-up food offerings, we started off with a walking tour by Michael Barnholden, who is a local poet and the author of Reading the Riot Act, A Brief History of Riots in Vancouver. So he'd been leading these 1907 riot tours for years, on and off, here and there. And it was during that walking tour that I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if I could just can this tour so it's available anytime? And it wouldn't be great if it was an interactive kind of tour where I could bring in imagery that would be related to the subject matter. And then I thought, oh, I just came up with my first ever 360 video idea, which I'd been waiting for years, because I've always wanted to work with the technology. And that's how it came about.
Tell me about the experience itself. What will people experience if they do this tour?
So for anybody who has access to the internet and has a computer or a phone and a browser, like, you know, Chrome, Safari, Edge, Opera, whatever, you type in 360riotwalk.ca and it'll take you to a website, and just somewhere along the line you can click on launch the tour. It'll take you to, well, the splash page of that thing. You get to choose a language: English, Cantonese, Punjabi, or Japanese. And it has the Squamish language embedded in each of the first stops of all of them. I tried to get Squamish, but the translators were just too busy. It's hard to get a translator.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just kind of stretched thin, right? Yeah. And then you just go to that location if you can, or if not, you just, you know, look at it on the internet, and you can make it rotate and zoom in and out and so forth. So here, like for instance, we're at stop 7 in Shanghai Alley. You see this image on the screen. You take your finger, you drag the image around until it lines up to what's directly in front of you. Then you tap the little green button, and that activates your gyroscope, which means it'll start to move with your body. So if you look up, the imagery will follow you up. If you turn left or right, it'll do the same. You can use your fingers to zoom in and out. Press play, the audio track goes, and there you go.
And what sort of images and content is in there for people to see?
There's like 120 or something like that images in there over the 13 stops. There's all the archival old pictures we colorized, and then the imagery of current Vancouver turned into black and white. Kind of did a flip, right? And superimposed where we can, the same locations, buildings, landmarks, etc. Gassy Jack was still there as a statue. So that's in the tour. And the very last stop, Oppenheimer Park, it was a tent city back then, so that's in the tour. And then a few other details have changed since then. There's documents, like for instance, the Royal Commission for Compensation that William Lyon Mackenzie King, well, it's just the front page of that one. But there's also drawings and illustrations from publications around that time, including from the U.S., that we set up almost like posters or billboards in the landscape, urban landscape, giving you a sense of the kind of sentiments that was prevalent back then, the anti-Asian attitudes, the kind of like tolerance for violence against the Chinese. Yeah, it could be a bit shocking for some people who aren't aware of the kind of environment people had to survive in. And, you know, again, reasons for, you know, the ghettoization of these people and of certain peoples within certain geographies, but also those places became safe spaces for them because they could protect themselves there as well.
And what do you hope that people who do the tour, walk through, visit the website, what do you hope they take away from the experience?
Well, I hope they learn a little bit about this place that we get to call home. If you have the privilege and the honor to live here, and if you don't live here, not just learn about this place, but hopefully you'll reflect upon your relationship to wherever you are and what stake you have in it and what you might take for granted. And hopefully also consider that not everyone has the same privileges, that some people are much more vulnerable than others, and what can be done about it.
And the reason I'm talking to you about this now in particular is because the Eastside Arts Festival is coming up and the tour is being included in that. What does it mean to have the tour as part of this arts festival that is focused on Vancouver's East Side?
You know, I'm really happy that it's part of the Eastside Arts Festival. It's ironic, though, because this project is focused on what used to be the center of Vancouver, right? But now it's the downtown East Side, which is actually a really large area.
Yeah.
Includes, from the water all the way to, I think it's 16th Avenue, maybe? Does it go all the way to, where does it go to?
Well, I mean, some Nanaimo? People would say, out to Commercial, at least, maybe Nanaimo. Down into downtown.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. It's in my book. Yeah, this whole project turned into a book, White Riot. There's a picture of it in there, and I forgot. I'm sorry. Not an urban planner, obviously. And it's not like we have a sign saying, you are now leaving the downtown East Side. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, and it might change in the future as well, what the designation is. So, I think it's the East Side Arts Festival. Well, you know, East Side versus West Side. I mean, that brings up a lot of real estate questions, right? Mm-hmm. Class and privilege questions, which is actually connected to, I'm going to segue here, connected to the strategy of Marathon Realty, CP Rail, because they got a huge piece of land on the West Side, and they wanted to make sure the West Side was always going to be better than the East, right? So that kind of differentiation, that which would always keep the land values higher, which would keep their investments more profitable, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, all that kind of awareness, there's legacies to today. Although the creep of effectively the West Side keeps moving east as Vancouver keeps growing. So does Eastside Arts Festival have panels about this? It'd be great, huh?
Yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah. So again, I didn't really answer your question.
No, that's interesting. Like, I think, first of all, the comment about, you know, it's interesting that it's the Eastside Arts Festival when this used to be the center of Vancouver, that it says a lot about the sort of cultural geography of this place. And as you're saying, the sort of like exclusion of certain peoples from parts of the city and the ghettoization and all of that, right?
Yeah, marginalization. Because,
mm-hmm. Like a real physical, geographical marginalization, right?
Yeah, that strip between Main and Hastings, along Hastings, for about three or four blocks west, that was the core of Vancouver. That's where the nice businesses were. That's where Woodward set up, right? The expensive stores where you would go and get a nice suit or dress or something. The best tailor in Vancouver was at Columbia and Hastings, run by a Chinese guy. So he had white clients. He was so good.
Yeah, well, and then it seems less and less possible that it's coincidental that, you know, the sort of core of the homelessness crisis in the area is right adjacent to Chinatown and is right adjacent to all these areas that historically were sort of non-white areas, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the effect of, I guess, the influential part of town moving away. And I guess that was more the 70s, you know, with the building of Pacific Center Mall and then the building of all the towers around, I guess, Burrard Street. So, yeah, the move west left something in its wake, and that never really got filled. Same way that the Powell Street area, you know, with the forced, when the incarceration of the Japanese Canadians, that left a lot in its wake and never really recovered as a fulsome a neighborhood as it was before. So, yeah.
All right, well, is there anything else you think people should know about your tour, your book, yourself?
Yeah, go buy the book. Yeah, White Riot. It's hopefully at your local bookstore, and if not, get them to bring it in. There are 7 contributors in the book, all of whom bring different perspectives and contexts in, ranging from labor activists to a piece about Chinatown and gentrification to why we shouldn't use the word Japantown, but either Powell Street or Paorugai, because the Japanese people living there never called it Japantown. So they want others to call it what they called it. They're also not saying that other places in North America should not call their Japantown Japantowns. It's just that specific to here. As a Chinese person, we call Chinatown Chinatown, but actually in Chinese, it's Tong Yan Gai, which is Tang Dynasty people's street. So, because the Cantonese identify with the Tang Dynasty, but in English, this kind of go, yeah, Chinatown, whatever. As opposed to myself making a fuss about how my name should be pronounced, because there's the romanization, T-S-A-N-G, but that's not how you say it. I mean, it's not English, so it's Zheng. And yeah, I'm not going to say my own name wrong.
Great. Wow. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.